Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, SULA, for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, we talk to Chelsea in the field, where she's spending some time on a dig in eastern Oregon, where Chinese miners once lived and worked. There's not only history being uncovered there, but some history of the dig itself, since it's gone on for multiple summers now. Chelsea Rose is with us on the phone, and Don Han is with us as well. He's a Forest Service archaeologist and the co-principal investigator at the site. Don, welcome to you.
Well, thank you.
Chelsea, so tell us where you are and where the work is going on.
Well, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to let you know that today we're in town until after this talk, because where we are totally out of cell range. Uh-huh. We are up in the mountains along the Middle Fork of the John Day River, working on two mining sites that are on either side of Big Creek. And they are part of the Ah Hang Mining Company that was being worked in the late 1880s.
Okay, I think you've already answered one question, whether people were mining for themselves or for bigger entities, and the answer sounds like a bigger entity.
Well, not necessarily. It was a group of Chinese miners. It wasn't one of the other situations where they were hired, Chinese laborers hired for a white mining company. This was a small kind of co-op. And actually, Don's been doing a lot of research into what that looks like, because historically, archaeologists didn't really understand what, how these Chinese miners were working and how they were organized out in the woods. So that's something he's really been researching.
Don, were there good records kept, or had this sort of disappeared from history for a while?
Well, I don't know that there were, if there were, might have been good records kept, but we don't have them now. There may be some back in China, which opens up some interesting ideas. But here in Oregon, eastern Oregon, there aren't a lot of records. That said, we do have some records at the Kamwa Chung Museum, some lease agreements where folks were leasing rights to do mining to the Chinese mining companies, and we have records at the county courts, which are the claim records and sales records and whatnot.
So what do we know about when the mining presence was established by Chinese miners up on Big Creek?
Well, the earliest actual documentation we have is a lease agreement that was 1881, I believe, early 1880s. And there may well have been a presence before that, but it looks like the initial strike in that Big Creek area was about that time.
So that was an initial strike, you're saying? Because I know in western Oregon, particularly in the Jacksonville area, the history that was told for many years was about the white miners working the claims and having them play out, and then the Chinese miners moved in. It sounds like the Chinese were the initial miners here?
No, there was a group of white miners that made the initial strikes, but very quickly they leased or sold rights on a lot of Big Creek to Chinese mining companies. And we don't quite know the dynamic there. There was no clear legal mechanism for the Chinese to file a claim, so they usually had to get it through a third party.
Oh, okay. So somebody who was white basically had to have the claim, and then they could hire other people to do the work for them.
Well, they weren't hiring them. They were actually either selling or leasing the rights.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't work for those folks. They negotiated an agreement to either give them a percentage of the profits or an outright payment, usually so much per year. And it's all documented on the lease agreements we do have, which are probably only a small percentage of the ones that were done.
So is the place you're digging on Big Creek the same place you dug the last couple of years?
Last year we started at Big Creek.
Mm-hmm.
So there are three broad areas, I guess you could say, where that we have evidence of substantial Chinese placer gold mining. And we started out at a different location called Happy Camp and worked there for a couple years. And then last year when we were done with that, we did our initial work at Big Creek, and that was very intriguing. And so we came back this year to get some more information.
And one of the cool things about this is now this is our third season working up here, and this is our fifth Chinese habitation site associated with Chinese mining in the area. So we're able to really get some great data and compare what we're seeing across these different parts of the forest. And some of these sites represent different eras of mining. Some are a little bit earlier, some are a little bit later, and they're all representing different individuals. So we're really starting to kind of see some patterns and to kind of tell a more nuanced story about what Chinese miners were doing out here in the Blue Mountains.
So give us a sense of what some of the overall patterns you're talking about then, Chelsea.
Well, you know, one of the big questions we have is access to goods. So, you know, we have a big data set from Southern Oregon with work in the Applegate and then in Jacksonville, and we want to see, are the foodstuffs, the clothing, the just things they're bringing in, are they the same as what we're seeing down there? One of the things that has been distinct to me, and part of this, you know, you never know how much is preservation or we just get lucky what we find, but one of the things that's my favorite up here is we are finding so many modified metal artifacts, like shovels that have been repurposed into different things, hand-forged items, and all different metal things that we've been trying to wrap our head around to see what the heck are all these things, and you know, is this distinct to the Chinese workers, or is this just this region? And one of the things that's really exciting is this particular round, well, when we were there last summer, we found a cache of shovels. Don was doing a metal detection survey and just kept seeing all these shovels. So this summer, we came back and peeled back a large area, excavated it, and darned if we didn't find the blacksmith shop. So we're really excited to see what we can learn about the way these items are being repurposed and reused, and if there's any sort of cultural markers that really are unique to the Chinese miners. And as far as I know, this is the first Chinese blacksmith shop to be excavated in Oregon. So we're pretty thrilled about this discovery.
That's fun detective work. I can imagine that after you've found all the modified metal stuff, you're thinking there has to be some ability to smelt or at least otherwise alter metal here. And bingo.
Yep. Yeah.
That is fun. Chelsea Rose is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. She is here from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology talking about the big dig in eastern Oregon with Don Han, who's the co-principal investigator with her from the Malheur National Forest. He's an Forest Service archaeologist. Questions, comments about what's going on out there, things they're finding about Chinese miners in eastern Oregon, working so far out of the country they had to come to town to be able to talk to us by phone, which we appreciate. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Don, I was looking over the pictures from last year's digs. It looks like lots of pits and lots of findings. And so it's a very, very intensive kind of project, isn't it?
It is. It's quite labor intensive. And as a government archaeologist, I have a lot of limitations on time and money to do these things. So the partnership we have with Chelsea and Southern Oregon University has been just incredible. You know, there's some seed money we can provide, but we get so much more work done. And we have students with developing academic interest that are going to go on and do thesis work and other things using the material here. So it's really exciting.
There's also some element of the Passport in Time program involved with this.
Yeah,
is that right?
Correct. Thanks for bringing that up. So Katie Withy is one of our district archaeologists out here working in our program, and she ran a Passport in Time project this year, had 20 volunteers over 2 weeks, and what they were doing, kind of two components. They went out to the sites we already knew that we wanted Chelsea to work at, and they prepped them. They got to do the glorious work of removing some of the brush and then running the initial metal detector examination to look where hot spots are, and then Chelsea could weigh that information and decide where to put the test units. So we did that at two sites, and now they're approaching a place we may work next year. We're juggling the information, which is near the original town site of Susanville out here, which was a major mining area.
So I was going to ask about trying to get the Passport in Time volunteers up to speed, but it sounds like they do the rough work that comes actually before the digging.
Well, there's a mix. That's how we used them this year, kind of a preparatory. But we've used them with doing the excavation work before. The range of experience is quite broad. There's some folks that have been working with PIT for years who actually have an anthropology or archaeology background and bring a incredible skill set to folks that just have a passion for history and this is their first opportunity. But we've done full excavations with Passport in Time folks.
Okay, good to hear. So, yeah, I was just thinking, otherwise they'd feel like they were the people removing the trash and not getting to do the real work.
No, we tried to make it sound more glorious.
And one of the goals of this project is to have as much transparency as possible, to share as much of what we're doing with the public. And so not only do we have an archaeological field school with students from, I think, four or five universities across the state, and two from Massachusetts, but we also are bringing in, you know, these citizen scientists that are going to come work with us through the PIT program. And then every week we've been having a lecture series that's free and open to the public in John Day or Canyon City, And that's another way we're engaging the local community. So we're trying to have this multi-pronged approach to share our enthusiasm and what we're finding with as many people in the region and beyond, so that we can really tell this story and get people interested in learning more about the history of Chinese immigrants in Oregon.
So while you're there, people know you're there. This is not like you report a couple months later. They're all aware at the time.
Yeah, before we went into the forest, we were working at the Kamwa-Chung State Heritage Site, which is a state park right in downtown John Day. And we did a public day, so we had a lot of folks filtering through throughout the week we were there and then as part of the public day. So the goal is, again, to really... You know, to not be secretive, we want to protect these archaeological sites, but we really want to share the story with people. So we're trying to figure out as many ways that we can do that. So we're good guests in this community, but also so that people here feel like they can share in the project as well.
Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange with Chelsea Rose from SULA, the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology. She is the co-principal investigator of a major dig out in the John Day part of Oregon, way out in eastern Oregon, in the Malheur National Forest. And that is where we pick up Don Han, who's her co-principal investigator. He's with the U.S. Forest Service, an archaeologist himself. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Questions, comments about what they're doing and what they're finding. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We talk a fair amount, more or less in passing, about the Chinese diaspora. And so, Don, when we talk about that, is this the departure of the Chinese people from the West as the exclusion laws came into place?
No, actually, it's almost the opposite. It is the spread of the Chinese people, particularly from southern China, really across the whole Pacific Rim and into other areas as they're looking for economic and social opportunities. So we're really focused on Oregon precisely, and then the Pacific Northwest in a broader context. But there were Japanese miners, lumber workers, and other folks. They worked in sugarcane in the Caribbean, for instance. So Peru has Chinese communities. Cuba, Havana has a Chinatown. So it's part of this broader movement of the Chinese.
So the economic opportunities in southern China were very, very limited, it sounds like, at that point in history.
They were limited. There was also, it was a big population. So and then some other issues driving people into that part of China that were making that problem worse. So they were looking for other opportunities. And there was a whole history starting in Southeast Asia of people from that part of southern China going out to improve their economic situation.
And the Pearl River Delta, where most of these folks were immigrating from, has a unique opportunity or advantage in China of being pretty much accessible to Hong Kong, mm-hmm. Macau, and then what was then Canton, which is now Guangzhou. So these busy, active ports were allowed a mechanism for them to out-migrate either temporarily or permanently to provide opportunities, economic opportunities that would support their family and their communities.
So, Chelsea, give us an idea of the dig site you're working up in Big Creek this summer. Does it appear that the miners were out there working all year, or did they come to town for winter, or how do they divide their time? Can you tell?
Well, it definitely would have been seasonal because there was only enough water to mine during certain parts of the year, and I can only imagine how snowy and miserable some of these sites would have been in the winter. So they definitely would have gone somewhere, but we aren't exactly sure where, whether that was John Day, Prairie City, perhaps to Portland. So that's another phase of the research that we're really trying to get into. One of the things that was really exciting for me, sometimes the biggest elements of the story are the smallest, most humble artifacts. We found several pieces of really small, highly polished glass. It almost looks like sea glass. And what that is gastroliths. So that means that they were raising chickens, because these are tiny artifacts that have been smoothed by being inside a chicken's gizzard. And you often find those when you have chickens being butchered on site or being raised on site. So the exciting thing about that is that kind of gives us an insight into what level of permanence or how established they are out in these remote areas, because they were established enough to be raising poultry to supplement their food with both meat and eggs. And that really kind of changes this from just, you know, a work site to more of a home. And that gets at the people and the community that we're really trying to get at through these artifacts. So that was one of the big finds for me this summer, too.
It's amazing to me the stuff you have to know, like, you know, the stuff that chickens will swallow to help their digestion process along indicates the presence of people.
Yeah, that's right. And that's, you know, archaeologists are anthropologists. So even the littlest piece of rusty metal, at the end of the day, we're always trying to get back to the person who made it or used it or sold it or left it there, you know, 100 plus years ago. That's really the goal, is to get to the people.
So, Don, over the course of a couple of summers at this site, then, are you getting a different sense, I mean, understanding things differently about the Chinese presence in that part of Oregon?
Oh, very much so. And it's been a very, I guess, kind of almost a moving thing. I've been working out here for 28 years, and I've known there was a strong Chinese presence with the mining. But connected with, once we got out and looked at the landscape and saw how extensive the mining was, that raised some questions for me. And then I went back to census records, and indeed in Grant County, Oregon in 1870, I don't have the numbers precisely, but around 80% of the gold miners out here were Chinese. And what really woke me up was, I think it was 42% of the total population in Grant County was Chinese. So it was a huge percentage of the people living and working out here.
42%, you said?
Yeah.
Wow, that is significant.
Yeah.
And that's not represented in the modern population, of course. And so that's due to a lot of the politics in the exclusion era. But one of the things that I think of this project and the work Don's been doing that's really game-changing to Oregon history is discovering how many Chinese individuals were out here and for how long they were out here. That is definitely not the story that's in the history books. There was a lot more folks for a lot longer living in these forests and working in these forests, and that is really exciting find.
So, but are there stories undertold because nobody who wasn't Chinese wanted to tell them?
I think that part of it is a strategy to kind of navigate some of the politics in the exclusion era, and I also think some of it is just that the documentary record is biased towards the white population, just because they were running the newspapers, and so a lot of times that's kind of the documents that you have access to. So we are we have one of our grad students involved in the project going to spend the next week at the Kamwa-Chung and around this area looking more into records. She can read Chinese documents, so that we're trying to add. There's got to be some more evidence of this, and so we just haven't been looking in the right places. And so, you know, now I feel like we have enough clues that there's more that we'll find, and the story will start to continue to fall into place. And I do think that Grant County had a large population, but also I know Jackson and Josephine County did as well. So I think that once we start to realize how many people were here in the state, this will be something that we can also look at other areas as well to try to really get a grasp on this historic community and their influence and role in early Oregon.
So the populations, the Chinese populations, got bigger and apparently stayed longer than we thought.
Yes.
Okay. Wow, a lot more to learn. And how much longer are you guys going to be out there on Big Creek?
Today is our last day.
Wow. That's a little sad, isn't it, when you get to the end of it?
Yeah, bittersweet.
Yeah, so Don, you mentioned, I just got a couple of seconds left here, but not getting a chance to dig much outside of season, so it's pretty much you the rest of the year, huh?
Well, I have a large team here working with me, yeah, but we're isolated from the rest of the state and working together to identify these things.
Okay, a lot of work going on there up the Middle Fork of the John Day River up on Big Creek to get the facts about what happened with Chinese miners back in that part of Oregon many years ago. This has been Underground History on the Exchange. Chelsea Rose, our regular partner from Sula, always good to have you.
Hey, great to be here.
Don Han from the U.S. Forest Service, thank you for joining us with your archaeology skills.
You bet. Thank you for the opportunity.
Take it easy. That'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. More coming up.